I feel like Americans have to leave behind the idea that we can have a kind of anarchist political state where just everything goes, and irregardless of what you say politically and irregardless of what you do, as long as you don't murder people, people can... You see this in Germany, where we now have the discourse if the AfD should be banned, where I would say there is a point if you staunchly say in your speeches and to a certain extent in your program, we need to abolish human rights. You are not compatible with the constitution and you are illegal here. And that parallel, quote-unquote, institution of the party needs to be banned within the country. And then we have to deal with all the consequences, which might not be easy, but it is better than to just allow someone who openly advocates against the constitution and the state. And I think, as an American culturally, that is a very hard pill to swallow. But that is like the following point moving forward, that there is no bad faith, one, because everyone just, at the end of the day, tries to further their ideology and tries to win, and whoever wins makes gets to make the rules. And two, as such, Democrats need to move forward and ban every unconstitutional part of the Republican Party. I think you have a really gamer understanding of how politics work. Okay. And I think the way you played video games kind of colors the way you speak about politics.
Okay, I disagree. It feels like, go ahead.
You think we have one set of rules, and those set of rules are there for everybody. But if someone inherently doesn't want to play with those rules, there's no way that you can close every loophole that those rules would work for even the people who don't want to work with the rules.
I guess that sounds like such a simplistic view of things that I feel like I wouldn't commit to such a dumb position. But if you think I have, then attack it. Go for it.
No, absolutely. I just want to make sure that we're on the same boat. It feels like this, but you can also summarize your position if you want to.
Well, I don't know. We're talking about a very broad thing. I don't know what we're like. This has gotten so broad. I'm not sure what we're saying. Like when you say just one set of rules, like clearly that we're functioning under different actors have different sets of rules that they have to adhere to. There are going to be times when the standards change slightly depending on what's going on. Like that could be a lot more variable than just one solid set of rules. But
so let's make a concrete example. Let's say we take the presidential immunity case.
Okay.
As I understand it, you would argue, well, technically speaking, there's nothing that could be done about this such that people in the Supreme Court or in the Republican Party would eventually, with enough power, not be able to change those rules, even though that ruling, I would say, goes against the Constitution.
I don't understand. I would say that people in the Republican Party won't be able to change those rules.
That you can't make those rules lock solid, such that they can't change those rules.
I don't think I'm understanding.
Okay, let me make the positive argument.
Okay.
I think whenever you speak about bad faith actors,
yeah,
it sounds like you're saying we can't produce rules that can solidify rules against bad faith actors. I would say there are no bad faith actors in politics. Politics is entirely about the realization of your political goal.
Uh-huh.
And when we start speaking about bad faith actors in the sense of Republicans or anti-constitutionalists going against the Constitution, we're kind of misinterpreting what those people actually are. They just want to create their own set of reality. And at the end of the day, nothing is stopping them to create that set of reality. But when you say those bad faith actors act in bad faith, it sounds like there should be an institution or something that should stop them. But I don't see what institution should be ever there to stop them if they reach just enough power to do what they want to do.
Huh.
And the analogy, okay, I see I'm not getting you here. The analogy that I feel is appropriate here is it sounds like when you speak about bad faith actors, it sounds like you think of the Constitution as like a balancing act, like a video game developer balancing the game. And the video game developers constantly trying to close loopholes and perhaps change the rules of the game such that people who continuously feed, who continuously grieve, who abuse or hack can be deterred. But that is not how politics works. Politics is everyone's just trying to self-realize the entire system. And a more apt analogy would be perhaps a game that is developed by two sets of ideologically opposed people who are constantly trying to ring across the next patch notes. And I feel like you, well, when you say, like I said, when you say bad faith actors can't be legislated with, it kind of, I don't want to say it sounds like you're giving up, but it kind of misses the point, I think. Is that convincing, or do you get in what direction I want to go?
Maybe. Keep talking in that direction, I think. Like, if we get abstract or reductive enough, mm-hmm. then I can morph any position into any position and agree with anything. But I feel like we're too abstract. I think I need to boil it down into something more concrete.
Okay, when you speak with Hutch, I don't want to throw some shade or anything, just to be 100% clear. Huh? But when you speak with Hutch, I feel like the disagreement is that you, the both of you, kind of adhere to varying degrees of how much we should adhere to the set of rules. Uh-huh. But you're both in agreement with the fact that there is a set of rules, and that that set of rules, principally speaking, cannot just be abandoned and cannot just be reconstituted. And it feels like Hutch is much more closer to the idea that the set of rules is fundamentally unchanging and fundamentally must be adhered to, whereas you are more in a direction of, we must adhere to the spirit of the rules, but we can bend the actual outcomes a bit more.
Well, I don't think we should bend the outcome. I mean, how, if you're adhering to the spirit, I don't know how you're bending the outcomes.
Well, the spirit at the end of the day is liberalism, though.
Well, kind of, but kind of not. I feel like there's a lot of contextual mismatch here. So just to drill down on just this particular example. Mm-hmm. So Hutch will say, we can't sacrifice our rule set to save our rule set, that would be morally bankrupt, kind of, and you would lose the rules. And then my argument in response is, well, we are sacrificing the rule set a little bit to save the broader concept of liberalism. And then we fight on that point, to where it sounds like you're saying you're trying to sacrifice the rule in order to save the rule. But what I'm trying to sacrifice is like a lower level or a higher level rule to save a lower or more or less abstract, I guess, rule. So like, I'm okay with breaking a rule about the current rule set with the goal of saving liberalism. I'm not trying to sacrifice liberalism to save liberalism, I guess, would be the way that I view it. Does that make sense?
Look, it makes sense. The example that I would make is, let's take the current Supreme Court ruling on the 14th Amendment. As I understand it, they said Congress needs to make a law to enforce it, right?
Yes.
Hutch, I think, would say, well, if that is what the Supreme Court said, we need to enforce that law. Whereas I feel like your position would be to just say fundamentally no, that position is unconstitutional and we're just going to ignore it.
Not necessarily, or I don't know what we mean when we say ignore it. I don't think I would just say we should ignore all laws. I think I would say we should.
Would you say
we could be a little bit bad faith, basically?
But that, would you say you should ignore unconstitutional laws?
No.
Why?
Because the executive doesn't get to choose what's constitutional or unconstitutional. That's up to the Supreme Court.
But let's say it's the Congress. Could Congress ignore unconstitutional laws?
No, not legislatively, no. They could pass an amendment to the Constitution.
Could the Supreme Court ignore unconstitutional laws?
Definitionally, it's impossible for them to do so right now, because we view the Supreme Court as basically being they're the secret people that can read. They're the only ones that can read the Constitution, and we don't technically have access to it the way that they do. So to say that the Supreme Court could violate the Constitution would be like saying that God could violate God's word or whatever. It doesn't make any sense, right?
Then why are you saying it is bad faith to ignore those laws?
Well, when you say ignore the law, we have to clarify. Do you mean like ignore the letter of the law or ignore the spirit of the law?
The letter.
Well, it'd be bad faith to ignore the letter of the law, because you're literally breaking the system of government. Like, everything would fall apart at that point, no?
Yes, but kind of no. I think it depends on what you want to move the government towards and if you're happy with those consequences. And I feel like there's a good argument to be made that every quote-unquote law-abiding citizen should ignore unconstitutional laws, which is easy to say, and I know, because everyone will say that, but it kind of goes towards the point that in politics there are no bad faith actors. They are just interpreters who want to kind of further their own agenda. In the secessionists in the 19th century, 18th century, they aren't really bad faith actors. They just created their own facts and went on from there. And had they won, they would have been, well, the winners, obviously, and their law would have been what remained. And when we speak of, go ahead.
So I understand what you're saying. We're in such abstract land. When I look at the people that seceded from the Union, I think they knew that what they were doing probably wasn't allowed. And it seems to be, without knowing a bunch of Civil War history, that they were ready to fight a civil war to prove that point.
Yeah.
If I walk into a restaurant and I see a black guy, and I legitimately think I live in a society where I can call this guy the N-word and nothing will happen, and I call him the N-word and he just, clocks me, that's a different reality than me walking into that same restaurant, you know, putting my dukes up and then calling the N-word, get ready to fight. Because I know what's going to happen if I do it the second time. Comparing it to the immunity stuff, Nixon was hiding that whole... is it Black Saturday or Black Friday or the Friday Night Massacre?
The Watergate affair, yeah.
Yeah, when he started firing everybody, it's because he knew he was fucked. He was gonna get completely fucked on everything because he knew that he was up to no good. He knew he was doing illegal shit. They were trying to hide it. They were trying to conceal it. And, you know, once everything started to come out, he knew he was going to get impeached. He fucking resigned. And then Ford pardoned him because there were criminal investigations in him. He knew that he was going to get indicted and he was going to be federally fucked. Mm-hmm. He's operating under that. This is why I try to say that, like, there's a difference between, like, a lawbreaker versus somebody who thinks that they don't have to follow the law. Like, criminals bring guns and masks because they know if they get caught, they're going to get fucked. But Trump is the kind of person who would rob a bank in broad daylight and say that it's his right to do so. And for some reason, Republicans are defending that idea. And, like, a system can't survive that. Like, systems can survive rule breakers because I think rule breakers operate in a weird way within the structure of the rules. Like, they know that if they get caught, shit's going to get fucked. But if there are people that are acting with impunity, and then if other people are supporting them with flagrant disregard of the rules, it's a lot, yeah, like they're outside of that rule system. Like, you do you understand what I'm saying? That, like, criminals and police officers and citizens all function within the same rule set, even though criminals quote-unquote break the rules. It's different than a person thinking that, like, oh well, these rules actually just don't even apply to me.
Just to summarize,
sure,
so that I know I understand, you're trying to say because criminals who are violating laws are precautionary about getting caught, are precautionary about escaping, they implicitly always know that if they get caught, they are fucked, and they're not doing it with impunity. So that acknowledges that they are kind of moving inside of the system, because if they are caught, they have to acknowledge the system, right?
Yeah.
I would disagree. Well, you're correct, but I think the lesson to be learned here is that criminals, very broadly speaking, would they have the power to enforce their crimes, they would most likely do it. If you have a person who's doing a massive bank heist and they have a private army to just ram into the bank, kill every policeman and every military, and then escape to another country, they would do it. And I don't think them bowing, quote unquote, to the law and to the system is not an admission of their wrongdoing, but rather an admission that they are powerless to do better. And I think that is the difference in kind between someone like Trump and the quote-unquote common criminal, since Trump has the power to just ignore everyone and the criminal. And I think they are kind of the same-ish actor.
I guess Nixon theoretically had more or less as much power as Trump kind of sort of does. I'm sure executive power has expanded a bit, but everybody else wasn't playing the game that way. Do you know any, like, international law?
It depends on what I...
Like, there's this concept of...
Like, human rights law.
Sure, there's this concept of, like, international... I think it's called customary law or customary international law. And the idea is that it doesn't have to be codified, but if every nation has acted more or less as though this is what you have to do, then these things become just as strong as the Rome Statute, stronger, because you don't even get a choice on whether or not to sign on to these things. International customary international humanitarian law is considered binding everywhere. You have to follow it because everybody acts that way. And when people start acting in a different way, I think it can break other people if they don't act that same way as well. And then we all just basically race to the bottom and it gets completely fucked. Yeah, I don't know what the point of that was, but I'm just saying that, like, everybody has to, I don't know how a rule set survives if people don't act in concordance with the spirit of the rules, at least.
I'm going to run through, I get what you're trying to say. You're trying to say if no one adheres to the law, essentially, everything breaks down and we don't have society. Is that a correct summary?
A little bit. That's technically the middle outcome, though. The worst outcome would be only one side adheres to the rule set and then the other side doesn't. But then the middle bad one is still really bad, which would be neither side adheres to the rule set. And then the best world is where ideally both sides adhere to the rule set.
No, okay, understood. I'm going to try to, like, preempt with a positive argument. I think the thesis here is that politics is a might makes right thing. And everyone is trying to follow their vision. And only the person at the end who wins is the person who, quote unquote, followed the rules because they won by default. You can see that, for example, in international law with Israel, or in international law, not to go to Israel, let's go to Russia. If today Russia ends the Ukraine war and they occupy the Donbas region and they just stay there in 10 years or in 100 years, as long as Russia doesn't collapse, this will be Russian territory. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That is an entire might makes right solution. And I think it would be wrong to call them bad faith actors in the spirit of international law, because they are kind of adhering to international law. They're just enforcing it via force.
They're not adhering to international law. They'd be in violation of international law, right? But they would just be enforcing their own will through...
Well, they would be in accordance with international law insofar that occupation of a territory necessarily follows to that territory belonging to said country.
Well, I don't think that's... I guess I can grant it for this, but that's not necessarily what... I don't think in the UN, I don't think part of the charter allows you to just... If you occupy a territory for long enough, you can take it from another sovereign state.
That is kind of how it works, though, yes.
No.
I mean, what do you think in 100 years, if Russia still occupies the Donbas, people are going to view this... Well, let me preempt that. Technically speaking, you're right. They would have to culturally take it over. If they were to take over the Donbas, build Russian settlements there, get
Well, I think there would have to be some like official recognition in the UN. There would have to be something passed. But my guess is that something the UN would either, or I'm sorry, Ukraine would either acquiesce or something would happen. They would find, you know, some treaty between the two of them, and then they would say, okay, fine, like this is the new state of affairs.
Kind of. They would eventually acquiesce to it. If in 100, like the scenario that I've just built here is, if in 100 years Russia still occupies the Donbas and no other war had happened, most people would look bad at Ukraine and say, well, you can't take it over. Much in a similar way as to how the eastern parts of Germany were lost to Poland and Russia. That is technically also an invasion where land just got taken, but because it is now culturally Polish or culturally Russian, no one thinks about
attacking it again. This is like at the end of World War II?
Well,
or World War
One. World Wars apply.
Okay, yeah. When Prussia and all, okay, whatever bullshit. Sure, but like, I think that like the UN and like recognizing sovereign states and all of this didn't become like a huge thing until, especially after World War II. No, I would agree with you otherwise. Well, but
why do Israelis settle then so much? Sorry,
why do they settle?
Why do Israelis push settlements to the West Bank land? What is the ultimate goal there?
Well, it's to own it completely. But I mean, what are you asking? Are you asking like what their legal argument would be, or?
Yeah.
If you're talking to a mega pro-Zionist scholar, their legal argument is going to be that the mandatory Palestine area that the United Kingdom, that the British government set up, basically said that after a period of however many years, 20 years or whatever the fuck, the government that emerges as a stable government in that region is the one that inherits the state, all the land. So Israel would argue that on the expiration of that mandate in 48, the Israeli government was the only government standing, therefore that entire country belongs to them. They're the only government there. None of the other mandatory periods had multiple governments emerging. It was always a singular government that inherited all the land. So that would be their argument.
I'm sorry, I haven't been precise enough.
Sure.
As I understand it, if you were to ask very Zionist people, they would say by occupying and settling the land and holding it for long enough, it essentially becomes ours. And eventually the UN, if the Palestinians will have to be pushed back far enough, would have to recognize this as part of Israel by a kind of force argument. If they were, it is unclear as far as I understand. And again,
I understand what you're saying. I just, but post UN, post like 50s, like I just don't think that land generally works that way anymore. I think it hasn't for a while. Like when the Soviet Union collapsed and they lost all of their satellite states, there wasn't like a big redrawing of borders even of those states, were there? There might have been, actually, I just don't know. Or like when Yugoslavia was split into different countries like that, they had like the UN, I think, I don't know who exactly was involved in drawing the borders, but I don't think it was like arbitrarily decided. Like there had to be like an agreement, I think, between the peoples living in there. No?
Yeah, across the satellite states. And the satellite states kept to get their mini government because the Soviet Union was, as the name implies, a union of different Soviet states that were all kind of like East Germany had its government views, but I don't think, as far as I understand, Ukraine or Czechoslovakia or other countries, they just kept their satellite status and weren't absorbed into anything.
Sure. Can I run like a quick side argument and then you don't even have to respond. You can just tell me that it's totally irrelevant to what you're saying. So like there is like, this is why I'm saying it's hard when you get too abstract because everything can reduce into everything else. So when you say like might makes right, in a way, Okay, I'm going to be even more abstract. I'm so sorry. This is like a Randian concept. Have you ever heard of the concept of like enlightened self-interest?
I'm not an Ayn Rand scholar.
Okay, then no one is. Okay, but like, if I have two friends and I've got three candy bars on a table, okay, like a self-interested person would find a way to eat all three candy bars, but like somebody who is like an enlightened self-interested person would share the candy bars with his friends and eat one for himself because he would recognize that in the long term, this is creating like a more stable dynamic between all of you. And it's encouraging some level of cooperation that's going to turn out better than you just trying to take all three candy bars every time you get your hands on them. So when we say like might makes right, I agree with you that that's kind of been the way of the world. But the countries that have enacted on the broadest sense might makes right typically don't practice might makes right in a macro sense because the world would descend into chaos, right? Like, you know, as much as Russia tries, they do like fabricate pretextual reasons to invade areas, recognizing that they can't just march into a place. They have to have like some peacekeepers there. They have to foment some civil unrest there, like they did in Moldova, like they did in Georgia, like they did in Ukraine before they go in and do it. Because even though they could just might makes right go in and take over everything, the U.S. could do this with all of Central and South America. We recognize that even though they were strongest, if we were to exert our might in such a naive or simplistic way, that not everybody on the planet would go along with that and everything would just completely fucking fall apart.
Yeah. What is the question?
What I'm saying is that, like, so when you say, like, might, the world is like, might makes right, that's like, it's kind of sort of true, but the mightiest actors don't act that way on like a micro level because everything would become like incredibly chaotic. So, like, it's true, but it's true in almost a meaningless way. Because that's not the rule set that the mightiest people have enforced a rule set that they generally play by. Mm-hmm. Although that's gotten worse, unfortunately, over the past few decades. That's what Carney's speech in was it Munich was about, or was it Brussels, when he said that there was like the fiction of the international rules-based order, was the idea that we kind of pretended this was here, but it was a fiction. But like the U.S. government, you know, and other strong countries are clearly not fully compliant, right? Like, despite Russia fabricating pretextual reasons to invade Georgia or Ukraine, it's not legal. It's not really. It's not even by the letter of the law internationally. And then same thing with the way the U.S. can, you know, everything in Iran and everything else is not really, like, even in a fabricated pretextual way, it's not really legal internationally. So like, it exists on like a so like, it's true, but it's true in a trivial sense. Does that make sense?
Kind of.
Okay.
I would say you're kind of emotionally loading the idea of might makes right. I would, for example, say the civil rights movement is a might makes right movement because at the end of the day, they got their goals through and kind of got their goals accepted, and uh-huh. everyone had to just acquiesce to it.
Yeah.
And the broader point that I'm trying to go towards is, it is in politics in general, but right now in the U.S., specifically, is imperative that we understand that Republicans are not in any abstract way bad faith, or that they're not in any abstract way not adhering to the rules. They are creating their own system. They are changing the system. Similar to, let's say you're playing, do you know what Uno is? Do you have that in the US, the game?
Uno, yeah.
The card game? Yeah, okay. Like, sorry, I culture differences. I never know what the... what other people know. It is remarkably strange that when I play Uno with different people, people have very, very word rules, and everyone kind of has their house rules. Uh-huh. There are official Uno rules, but when I go to someone, it's always a bit of a gamble what rule set we're actually using. At the end of the day, one person kind of wins out over the other person because they acquiesce to the rules.
Yep, but hold on. Really importantly, in your example, when one person wins out, what happens when you guys play?
One person acquiesces. One gives
yeah,
up.
Yeah, but
and the other
when you
gets
guys
the rules through.
When you guys go to play the game.
Oh, no, you mean they both adhere to the rules?
Correct.
That is true. But the broader point that I'm trying to make here is that there is not some amorphous point of rules that everyone needs to follow, because from the perspective of the official rules, both people, even if they acquiesce to one set of rules, are bad faith actors because they're misappropriating the original rules and
so
are using the homebrew set of rules.
So here's my here, this is why I would say you can be like a type of bad faith actor. And it's because when you guys do your Uno thing, the reason why it's so important to recognize that both of you are playing by the same rule set is, imagine if you went to some game of Uno and imagine some guy said like, well, this is the rule set that we play with, you know, where we count every one and two as a wild card. And you're like, okay, fine, we'll do that. Imagine if they told you, no, actually, you still have to play with the original rule set and we're going to play only the wild card rule set. Well, now it's like, well, hold on, this is fucked. And my issue with the current thing that the Republicans are doing is that if both sides played by the same rule set that Republicans are trying to develop, the country would be, it would be a disaster. The country would fall apart. But Republicans are currently playing by their rule set with the assumption that Democrats won't ever emulate it. And I think that's, unless there's like some moral argument for why different people should be held to different moral standards that are otherwise equivalent people, like just because of different political beliefs, that can't be, I can't accept that. So that this is my criticism, I guess, of the way Republicans have set up the current system.
No, absolutely. And I get that. But my response to this would be that going forward, Democrats have to think about what they actually want. And that is then the rule set, or the, not necessarily the rule set, but the vision of what they want to enforce. And within that vision, I would say the next goal should be the dissolution of the Republican Party. And then perhaps a post.
Well, but it has to be the, whatever rule set you create, it has to be a rule set that like everybody is going to enjoy playing by. Because if you just craft these like unidimensional, these like one-sided rule sets, then the other side's not going to play by it, and you're just going to both, you're just going to be like spiraling to the bottom.
No, you're going to craft.
So you have to craft a rule set where you can lose and where the other side can win, so that they accept that rule set and they're willing to play by it. No.
Well, no, because you could just craft your rule set that you want to have, and then you enforce it.
Yeah, but then the outcome of that is probably going to be worse than a game that both sides agree to play. Like, I don't want to live in a one-party state where the other party has been dissolved.
Well, it doesn't have to be a one-party state, but the... How do you think the Republicans will ever come back?
Well, I think we have to do a lot about the social media algorithms. But I think if Republicans knew that there was going to be retribution, nonviolent, if they knew there was going to be retribution for the actions that they committed, then they just wouldn't do the actions. But right now, it seems like Democrats won't do anything. That's always been the impression that Republicans have had. So they've always had the feeling that they could operate with impunity.
Let's say you are the government of the Weimar Republic. And it is, I don't know, like 1929, 1927, and you see Hitler's rise to power. Without dissolving, thank you. Without dissolving the Nazi Party, what do you do? Or what would you do? How would you try to handle the situation?
Fuck, I don't know. But I also don't think dissolving just the Nazi Party would help.
Why? That is, sorry.
Well, one thing I would say
question
that you have to be really careful of is comparing modern America to post-World I Germany. Because I think post-World I Germany had legitimate grievances that that country was experiencing something that was just completely fucked from their perspective. Like, it was actually completely fucked. And in the wake of it being completely fucked, I think a lot of people were beginning to look for, multiple political parties were spinning up that were looking for non-democratic solutions to, you know, how to save themselves from the situation that they found themselves in after, I guess, the fall of the empire or whatever, right? After World War One.
So I
don't know how you would regulate your way out of like a, failing state.
You kind of ban every party that is anti-constitutional.
And you think that would,
as long as you have the power monopoly.
Well, like, don't you literally have on the border of your state, like a state who's, was it the Tsarists or whatever? They just got fucking all overthrown and murdered. And now you're going to just ban all of the opposing political parties in the hopes that people chill and your country that's like hyperinflating and is occupied by black French soldiers and everything is getting fucked. Like, I don't know if that would be a successful plan of action, no?
Do you think the alternative? Okay. Do you think the best alternative would be to just let them be?
I don't think it's not like the Nazi Party was just one of like, I don't know, was it like six or seven different parties in Germany that were all like anti-democratic, I think mainly right-wing parties. But even on the left side, there were, I don't know if they could have like politically regulated their way out of that.
That the Nazi Party was actually banned after the Beer Hall Putsch?
Sure. But the Nazi Party wasn't anti-democratic right-wing or left-wing party.
Well, yeah, it's a difference in kind, really, because we have parties like the Nationalists, which kind of weren't really democratic at all, but still did good governance. And we have figures like Hindenburg, who also wasn't really democratic, but kind of acquiesced to the constitution. And then on the other hand, we have the Nazi Party, who are just, well, the literal Nazis. Uh-huh. And I think there's a difference in kind between how radical both sides are. And I agree that there must be you can't just ban every opposition away. Entirely true. But I think in the American perspective, it always feels like when people are discussing what is allowed and what is bad faith and what is good faith and whatever, it feels like there's a sentiment of just everything goes and we can't do anything against quote-unquote unconstitutional things. And it feels like that is just a downstream admission of defeat from the idea that we can't do anything against bad faith actors.
Well, to be clear, I'm not saying we can't do anything against bad faith actors. It just probably isn't going to be like creating more rules that they've already shown that they have a total and utter disregard for. Mm-hmm.
Do you think Donald Trump should have been banned from the ballots?
100 million% yes. By the 14th Amendment, though.
Yeah. Why is that the case, but the Nazi Party couldn't have been banned?
I'm not aware of any, like, Weimar Republic law or something that they had violated or broken that would have... I do know that Hitler being released from prison or whatever was probably stupid.
Well, they literally tried to coup the government.
Yeah.
As a party. I think... Do you remember our last discussion, perhaps? I know that you've been, like, kind of carrying the parallel structure talking a bit forward, but something that I've tried to emphasize last time is that it's not just that there is a Republican establishment, but uh-huh. also there's a Republican underground. Uh-huh. And I think it is naive to think, oh, if we just ban Trump, everything is going to be quote-unquote fine, and we can kind of legislate our way through bad apples and bad presidents.
Yeah, this is actually a fairly influential conversation for me. I focused a lot more on when I bring up like the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society or whatever. Yeah. It's a thing that I've thought of more ahead in my Tim Miller notes, yeah.
Which I'm thankful for, by the way. But the next point in that chain of logic kind of would be to say, well, if that is the case, we kind of need to do something against those institutions. And that underground needs to be, to the extent of that it is unconstitutional, not undemocratic, but unconstitutional, removed from the country. No?
Maybe, but are we leaving the Germany example and going back to the US? My big issue between the US and the Germany example is that, like, I feel like there were material conditions and issues of national pride and feelings about what, you know, the empire was prior to the World War I collapse and everything, that there were super understandable reasons in my mind why people in Germany were getting hardcore radicalized by the conditions that existed post-World War I, right? And then in the United States, there are reasons, obviously, why Republicans are the way they are, but they're not... A lot of them, I think, are, I would argue, fabricated or put in front of people. Like, this is a very difficult counterfactual, but, like, do you acknowledge that there is a world where, I'm going to get clipped for this, but, like, in the long run, World War II might have actually been way better for Germany than if World War II had never happened? Like, imagine the Great War is the final world war, and then there's a status quo that develops post-World War One, and then that just carries forward, you know, 100 years into the future, and then Germany just kind of grows out of it and becomes whatever it was after World War One. Like, is there a world where that Germany is actually worse than the Germany that exists today? Yeah, go ahead.
Did you say the world is better if World War II never happened? Or did you say World War II would be better if World War II never happened?
I'm saying, would Germany, is the Germany that exists today as a result of World War II potentially a better Germany that would have existed had Germans accepted the status quo in World War I and just carried forward? Like, right now, I know that's a very unfair counterfactual, because Germany is like one of the economic powerhouses of fucking Europe, and it's hard to imagine Germany necessarily doing, I mean, they seem to be doing pretty well, I would say, all considered. But like, so it almost seems like I'm setting up a counterfactual where I can only win. But like, I'm trying to appeal to like a fact of the matter argument a little bit here, more than just like the fact of propaganda. Mm. Like, when Trump says this country was shit and now it's the hottest country ever, he's lying. But when Hitler and everybody says, you know, they've taken everything from you, all of Europe is laughing at you, you know, we're fucked, this is bullshit. Like, there's obviously a lot more truth to that. And I don't know if the Germany that would have grown in the status quo post-World War I could have ever grown to the heights that the Germany that, you know, came out of World War II and the world, the kind of like the world order that came after World War II. I don't know if the Germany that could have grown in the world order post-World War I necessarily would have grown to the same heights as the Germany that existed post-World War II after the new kind of world order with the UN and everything else. I know that's a really devil counterfactual, but...
Well, it kind of depends on what... It kind of depends on what additional things you're willing to grant. Uh-huh. I don't think that had Germany stayed the way it had, and had France continued to establish dominance through the Treaty of Versailles over Germany, uh-huh. I do think Germany would have been in a worse position. Most likely because, as far as I understand, there had been plans by the Soviets to expand further west.
Sure, yeah.
And the Soviets, through the Comintern, were trying to, well, destabilize the entire West. And
every single,
global, yeah.
Which was still, I know we look at it retrospectively as being stupid and silly now, but all of Europe, I think, right, was scared about, like, the communists. Yeah, yeah, and the Soviets were explicitly trying to foment that, you know, like, red parties and shit, or red parties or whatever through other countries, yeah. But ignoring that, we'll assume there wasn't a massive communist egg or whatever all of Europe, but yeah.
Yeah, but then we have to assume that the big thing why Germany is the powerhouse, quote unquote, amongst other things, it is, besides its location, besides its culture, besides its decentralization, is the fact that for the longest time it was the border of the Cold War. And so it had massive interest from the United States and from every other, quote-unquote, ex-allied nation except for the Soviets. Uh-huh. So on the Soviet side, people were trying their best to establish a wall, a military, a state within a state that they could occupy and eventually launch attacks from through the Warsaw Pact. And on the other side, people like the United States, like the United Kingdom, like France, had to ally with Germany because they were the forefront of the next war. And France didn't want to be the partner, well, not the partner, the border to Russia, similar to how Germany tried to lobby Poland into NATO, because then Germany wouldn't be the border to the Russian quote-unquote empire that then persisted.
Sure.
So I think you're kind of right with your counterfactual, but only because there was an interest of the United States in Europe, and there was an interest of the remaining empires.
What I'm kind
of
saying is that, like, we shouldn't take it for granted that, as horrible as everything was for World War II, that Germany ended up in a better place because the material conditions and everything were so dire post World War I. In the United States, I don't think you can say the same thing about Trump. That's why I don't always like to make the comparisons. Like, I don't know if there's ever a world where I can say, like, man, you know, it was kind of rough, but thank goodness Trump was here for these 8 years. Like, you know, we probably, you know, we came up, like, I just don't know if that's ever the case. Like, the world, the entire world and the US would be better with Hillary in 2016, would be better with Joe Biden 2020, whatever. Yeah, but go ahead.
I think you're using hindsight to bolster your argument, because I don't think that anyone in Germany in 1946 would say, well, now that Hitler is gone, we can enjoy our great germination again. And I don't think that anyone in 1950 would say that. And I don't think anyone in 1960 would say that.
True, but if I were to ask them in 1950, right, what were your fathers, grandfathers, you know, what were their feelings of, you know, Germany, you know, during the First World War and immediately after, they would be able to point to real issues of just of insane despair, of the French and the fucking Ruhr or whatever, the hyperinflation, the, you know, the destruction of their country, just the everything, the way that they were viewed in the world stage, like everything would be just that. But whereas for the Trump stuff, it's like what happened in 2016 at the end of Obama, right? You've got one of the smartest political men, Shapiro, saying, well, Obama said that Henry Louis Gates, you know, he made a comment on that case earlier. And then he said that the kid that got killed by Zimmerman, what was the kid's name? Fuck. Trayvon Martin. He said Trayvon Martin looked like his own son. Like, that's the complaint. Like, I don't think, like, I think you could find Germans, you know, in the late 40s, however embarrassed or ashamed they might have been, for like, damn, what the fuck happened with you guys? You know, what was going on? Like, they'd be like, you know, shit was fucked. Yeah, we're not proud of it, but shit was fucked. But like, for conservatives, if they had a sober, true look of the past in, you know, in 2030, like, guys, what the fuck? What happened with Trump? They're going to be like,
I disagree.
Obama was black, you think so? Oh, yeah, go ahead. Explain. Yeah.
I think I think in 1979, manufacturing peaked in the United States. And from there on out, the Rust Belt deindustrialized into the 2000s with the first China shock following the financial crisis. And I think if you line those events up, there is a somewhat clear path to the radicalization in a certain sense of some parts of the United States. And I think something that plays very easy into those realities is that there's no safety net in the United States. If you are sorry, you can tell me if I'm wrong here because I am not American, but from what I understand, if you were a worker in the Rust Belt, let's say you've been born in the 60s, you kind of go into manufacturing and your jobs slowly decline. It gets taken over by automation. It gets outsourced. It goes to India. It goes to China. And then suddenly the China shock happens. China comes into the world stage, takes over massive amounts of manufacturing, massive amounts of outsourcing are happening, and you're suddenly not homeless, but you're jobless. And then the financial crisis happens, which obviously hits disproportionately affects poorer people. I do see that there is economic unrest there.
I agree with you that there can be, kind of, but materially, this is like so different, right? Like, the United States went from being a manufacturing powerhouse. Like, why did we abandon some of the Rust Belt? It was because we found even more productive stuff to invest our nation's resources into. It was crypto, AI, software related stuff. We found that other countries could manufacture these things for cheaper. We have the most, one of the most productive workforces in the country. We have, I think, one of the strongest or the strongest domestic purchase market, like import market in the country. The US consumer is the strongest consumer in the world. Like, you can argue that this damaged people in the United States for sure. But I think Germany was the number one manufacturing like powerhouse of the world in World War I. And I think I don't remember. But after Versailles, didn't they lose like half their, I don't know if it was like their fucking mines or their manufacturing plant, but like their shit got fucked. And it's not like they were like, oh, let's stop all of our iron refineries because we're going to start doing software. It was, oh shit, it's being taken by other countries because we lost a war and our empire has been divided and we're fucked. Like, you can make an argument for some disproportionate amount of harm related to Rust Belt manufacturing in the United States, but that was for the country to advance as a whole, which it obviously and undeniably did, maybe to the detriment of some individual workers in the US, for sure, or a section of workers in the US, for sure. You can make that argument, but I don't think that's at all comparable to like Germany as a country being severely harmed or damaged post World War I. Now, I'm not trying to argue that what I'm saying is that the difference is because of how it's happening, that this is like a difference in kind to where I can I think given the facts on the ground, obviously it would sound crazy to say this today, but like I can be sympathetic towards where Nazi sentiments or far right sentiments or anti-democratic sentiments came from in the Weimar Republic. I'm sympathetic to that. I can't be sympathetic to the facts on the ground for Trumples. That's just
can you
yeah.
Can you be sympathetic to a certain extent that if you, let's say you are, we go 10 years back, it's like 2016, it's maybe even 2012. Can you be sympathetic to the fact that some people might just feel disenfranchised with the politics of the United States? And it feels just we're basically going back from the Clintons to the Bushes, back to, well, Obama, but then back to the Clintons. And there's this growing feeling of poorer people are losing their jobs. Uh-huh. They are the big losers of the financial crisis. They can't afford their healthcare. There's no safety net for them.
Yeah.
And now there's like another Clinton, like another dynasty that's going to...
Yeah, I could definitely feel that.
Yeah.
Which in my mind would make me understand, like, man, I hate it, but I understand Clinton lost and Kasich won or Rubio won or Cruz won. But Trump? Now, to be fair, I'm a lot less critical of the first Trump election than the second one, which is just beyond comprehension to me, because in the first one, even I was on the fence initially in terms of like, well, maybe once he's like president, he'll kind of like turn it on and he'll stop being such a weirdly confrontational, divisive guy. But I mean, he never really did. And obviously by the end, he was trying to coup the government. But they still chose Trump over every other alternative. It's not like that. It's not like it was just Clinton versus Trump. Trump emerged victorious from a primary of like 11 candidates.
I'm going to be a tiny bit personal because I followed politics.
You can be mega personal
as well.
Go
in 2000. Uh-huh. What? Yeah.
You can be mega personal. Go for it.
Yeah, it's a bit shameful, so like, don't hate on me. But had I been in the United States and had I been 18 in 2016, I probably would have voted for Trump.
Sure.
Because the feeling that I got at the time was the exact same that I said. It felt like everyone is just a corporate suit. Everyone is kind of doing their very high-level, sophisticated politics for the donor class, to invoke Cenk Uygur here. And it felt like Trump was an outsider, a brush of fresh air, someone who would have been able to shake up the system, ironically. Now with the knowledge of hindsight, I know that to govern effectively, you need experience in governance, and governance isn't as easy as just go there, like sign a law, and then that's it. But I feel like that is caused by a lack of education.
Yeah, and a lot of stuff. But I could also understand what where were you living in? Where are you from, Germany, or do you live in Germany?
Yes, I am from Germany.
And so, right when Trump is running in 2016, were you living in Germany the whole time?
Yeah.
Like I can't speak to everything, but I imagine there's like growing discontent across Europe post refugee crisis, the global financial crisis hit Europe a bit. You'd had Angela Merkel for what, over a decade at that point.
16 years.
Yeah. By 2016, time, yeah. So like I could see somebody in Germany like having that feeling of like, do I want another decades long business as usual politician when everything just feels like a little bit not okay right now, or do I want to shake it up a little bit? That's why I'm saying, like, I'm even sympathetic to your view there, but even in America, I'm sympathetic to Trump 1 voters, even though I think there were problems, but like, I'm somewhat sympathetic towards them, but Trump 2 is like, Jesus. But also like, yeah. I just don't think that Trump 1 necessarily, well, no, yeah, no, I'll just say that. Yeah, I'm somewhat sympathetic to Trump 1 voters, yeah. For that, yeah.
No, absolutely. But the point that kind of gets us back to the initial conversation. Do you know of the term Gleichschaltung? I think equalization would be a good translation in Nazi Germany.
No, I'm not aware of that term.
Where everything, basically, essentially, the state has taken everything and put it in line with the state's agenda. Okay. So private production is state's focused. As long as you go with the state,
you're going to run your business. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That is kind of what happens with the Republican Party. They just equalize. And everyone who already was in there just got inducted? What's the word?
Inducted? Introduced?
They got forced... Inducted. They got forced deep into the cult.
Okay.
And I do understand that the way that in the United States politics is set up, it is very much a team game because you only have two solutions. And thus, if you are in that team and you only get to hear how much Trump is winning,
yeah.
you day in, day out, and you get sucked deeper into those institutions that now start recruiting on campuses, that mm-hmm. now get their lawyers through the entire thing that we discussed last time. I do understand why people kind of go down the road and start to radicalize. Like one of the well-studied phenomena in psychology is the phenomenon of group radicalization, where sure. you essentially do you know of that? Do you know that?
No, but I get, based on my experiences in life at this point, I can guess. Okay. But you can tell me where you're
going. So the classical setup is the classical teaching moment is you have a group of students and a lecturer, and every student, well, they kind of either don't like or they're a bit on the fence about the lecturer individually, but then they get together and they start to radicalize, because one student might say, I really don't like his lecture slides. And the next one goes, oh, yeah, that is true, but I also don't like the way he kind of speaks, and he does a lot of M's and ums. And then the next one comes and goes like, oh, he's always so sweaty and like, uh-huh. not really. And so it just continues, and you just add to every little part until the people, although individually they're not radicalized, as a group are much further down the road, and you just...
Sure.
You can't really get back there. And I feel like that is what's happening to the Republican Party. And
Yeah. Sorry. This is part of what I argue about, or I kind of tease this concept, actually, when I talk about how we've withdrawn into different political realities. The lack of testing or conflict between both sides there, like, causes them to become so much crazier than they would otherwise. That if you were to have a, you know, frequent debate in the United States over the minimum wage, you know, maybe in the middle we find that minimum wage comes to be $12 an hour, while people on the far left are pushing for $15 an hour and people on the far right are pushing for no minimum wage, that if you separate these groups in a very short amount of time, I think I'm seeing now people are arguing, I feel like I've seen lawmakers or far left Democratic, I don't know if these are political figures or candidates running for races, say that like we need a $25 an hour minimum wage. And it's like, we didn't even get 12 or 13, 25 an hour federal minimum wage. What the fuck are you? And these are still like in like mainstreamish candidates running for races spaces. I can't imagine. Well, in the individual conversations, they're not even talking about wages. They're saying capital needs to be abolished or whatever, but they accelerate and they get so crazy so quickly. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
The two points that I'm trying to make is, on one hand, when you say we have to adhere to the laws and we have to fight bad faith actors, it sounds like you're adhering to a world order that is gone. And I would rather the discussion being centered around what is the next thing we want to go towards. As it stands, the system is fucked. It is like...
Yeah, I think I generally agree with that directionally. Like, because I'll make the same complaint when you brought up like the Rust Belt stuff. Like, you can't go back. You can never go back to the way things were. I agree with that, right? Unless you have a very, very clear path to do it. I would argue that there, in my world, I think there is a clear path to do it, because the thing that I would want is to get rid of the algorithmically generated and sorted media feeds. I think I actually didn't even realize until today how insane it actually has gotten for some people. Like, I don't know if you watched earlier when I was watching Asmongold's stream.
No, I haven't, sadly.
I didn't know this, but like every single Asmongold stream is literally just him scrolling his For You page on Twitter. That's what he does for 8 hours every single day. And then he just disseminates that to his audience. Yeah, unironically. And I mean, Hasan's not quite as bad, but he's pretty close as well, where it's just him scrolling his Twitter. Like the different worlds that can be created for you based on the social media feeds that are like serving you content is so destructive. Like, it is, I agree with you that, like, that is a world that you could fight in by doing it on our side. But I think both people engaging in that fight, I don't think it produces any good outcome. Because, like, this is more specific and less abstract, but, like, in a democracy or in, like, a marketplace of ideas, the reason why both people fighting tends to produce a better outcome is because both people are fighting on, they're fighting for the same reality. They're not both constructing their own realities. Right, you have like a, yeah, but yeah,
kind. Sorry, go ahead, and I'll.
Well, you can tell me why you disagree. Like, I feel like they do. Like, you, as crazy as you want to be, if you want to sit here and scream, you know, liberals love violence. If I'm there and you have an audience with me, you have to address what I'm saying. Trump does not disavow violence. Even if you're screaming back and forth at me, everybody listening to you is going to hear me saying that, and that's going to do something more then, because of the radicalization thing that you talked about, right? Like, they might want to stick to their point of like, well, you know, the liberals are violent. The liberals are violent. While I'm shouting that, you know, Trump doesn't disavow, you know, it's an annoying conversation for me to have. And somebody could say, well, look, they're trying to create their own reality. But if I wasn't there, or if there was no opposition there, they wouldn't even be talking about how the liberals are creating violence. They would be controlling the Department of Justice and filing indictments against organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center, claiming that even right-wing violence is actually just staged by institutional left-wing actors. And that's where we're at right now. That type of thing is so much crazier than them screaming at a liberal disagreeing with them. That the lack of conflict and the lack of critical engagement from both sides has allowed the sides to separate. And then especially the right, and then I would argue the far left, has capitalized on this immensely to where they're just spinning off their entirely own realities. And that lack of engagement, I think, is just fatal. I don't think we can survive that.
I think that is a very American way of viewing it, in the sense of that it feels like the American political discourse has always in the back of its mind the idea that if we just, I don't want to say sunlight is the best disinfectant, because I know you hate that one, but it feels like people are just trying to say, oh, as long as we bring everything to the forefront and as long as we engage, everything will eventually level out and there won't be any radicalization. But that kind of ignores how those parties and those radicals were.
So I understand, example, what you're, well, real quick, sorry, I understand what you're saying, because I agree with this 1,000,000,000%, but like, you agree that it's probably important to eat a well-balanced diet and get a lot of protein if you want to go to the gym and build a lot of muscle, right? Yeah, yes. I'm not trying to trap you. There's like a specific...
No, it is a bit morally loading if you say a well-balanced diet, because that kind of...
As in a proper assortment of like macros and micros. It could be vegan if you wanted to. What?
Sorry, I'm not thinking you're going to trap me. I'm just thinking to make the best counter argument for this. Let's just grant it. Let's just say
sure. Let's grant it. Yeah, thank you.
I'll,
okay.
I'll agree.
Yes.
Sorry.
So you need to have an appropriate diet if you're trying to put on a lot of muscle. If you were given somebody who was starving to death, you wouldn't be going towards like an optimal bodybuilding or powerlifting diet. You would just want this person to eat something at all. So like, when you tell me that simply platforming an idea is not enough, I agree with you 1,000,000,000%. I've spent probably the majority of my political career fighting against bad platforming. However, even bad platforming today, I would take bad platforming over the complete lack of platforming. That's how bad and far gone it is. So I agree with you. Trust me, bro, nobody has cringed harder at that fucking sunlight is the best disinfectant bullshit. Like, I hate all the marketplace of ideas. Like, I used to make fun of Ruben and everybody for saying this shit all the time. But like, it's better to have like that type of back and forth, where even if it's like bullshitty kind of, versus right now where it's just not at all. It's completely nothing. Like, yeah.
Yeah. The issue as I see it is that even if it were quote-unquote good platforming, the people who are already radicalized will only radicalize themselves further. To like make a personal example, I think if you and Hassan were to debate, the people who are in his community would inevitably go away with the impression that you did bad and he destroyed you, ever, always. And I'm pretty sure that by the mere fact that you debated, he could then tell his audience, well, I debated him and I crushed him, so obviously... Like, it is the same what happened with the Finkelstein discussion.
I super disagree with you there. And I think that the record, and I think the reality of today, I think actually bears out my argument. Because if that was true, then why wouldn't Hassan debate somebody like me or XQC?
Because he's fragile.
No, I think it's because he knows because there's fragile. Nothing to gain. There literally isn't. And because he is afraid that he would lose. Hassan and me would have a debate, and I agree with you that the majority of voices in both communities would definitely claim, you know, the respective victory on either side. But there would be enough. First of all, Hassan, even when he goes on these fucking libcuck platforms with John Slurper, whatever, from Pod Save America, like, he has to moderate his message even for that libcucked audience. Hassan is never going to be saying any of that crazy, insane Marxist shit around me. So he's already going to have to moderate the fuck out of his position. And then even on that, like, I can fight and push for things. And even if his audiences feel like he kind of, you know, has won on some points, he's going to have to answer questions that he ordinarily never has to answer. And the cracks will show. And that would be with just one debate. But imagine if there was, like, a culture of doing that stuff pretty constantly. Like, there's a reason why I think all of these people have gained so much power by avoiding all these types of conversations. Like, they just don't do it.
Yeah, I get what you're trying to say, but I would make the same argument that you made earlier. We can't go back to that because the bubbles have settled now. And if we're going back a bit and have those massive debates, let's say we have like debates between Shapiro and I don't know who's like on the left side, the equal of Shapiro, but like we have those big debates. Uh-huh. The bubbles, as they have already formed, have been formed. And the people that would have been convinced in the argument that you just made are the groups that are neither aligned with you strongly, but are also not aligned with Hassan strongly.
So here's where
the group that...
So this is where I'm leaning into the social media aspect for being so important to this, and the thing that I think is kind of invisible to a lot of people. I understand what you're mm-hmm. saying, but the thing is that I don't think that those types of people that insulate themselves, I don't think that it would be as successful because they just wouldn't gain the traction otherwise without having a social media algorithm that reinforces their political team. So like if Hassan says, I'm not going to engage with anybody, it's okay, because if I go into social media, anything, and I engage friendly with some far lefty stuff, I'm automatically going to get connected to so much other far lefty stuff. I'm automatically going to get hooked up to all of this. I'm going to have my own little reality served up to me, and that'll be okay. But if that didn't exist, and I had to go out and manually find stuff, well, now, you know, if I'm scrolling a thing and it's just chronological, well, now I see Hassan says that all capitalists are evil. And now I see the next post is Destiny says Hassan fucked a 15-year-old in a German brothel. And then the next post is like something on Fox News. Well, now it's a lot harder. There's a lot more conflicting information here. And I'm either going to disengage or have to form at least a slightly better opinion about everything going on, because I'm not going to get one-sided slop served to me constantly through those algorithms. And I think that encourages more for people to kind of fight a bit more honestly about what it is they're trying to further, because they can't rely on a totally false reality. Like, without these social media algorithms, Hassan would have had to apologize for the dog shock thing. But because of how strong the insulating factor is behind, I think, these social media algorithms, people like Taylor Lorenz can say, ignore your eyes, he didn't shock his dog. And that works. It's okay. There's no critical confrontation there because you're constantly connected with other people that agree and say the same thing.
I think there are two parts that need to be separated here. Mm-hmm. For one, and you can tell me if you disagree with this.
Sure.
The hypothesis that I will argue for is, if you are correct that it is not solely, but in large part due to the algorithms, were there equivalent talking heads, of course not equivalent to Hassan, because that space is more driven by young people, uh-huh. but were there equivalent talking heads on the Republican side before social media, before Facebook? And I think the answer is yes. I think uh-huh. the people just kind of shifted their environment. And I'm 100% on your side. I think algorithmic content should be banned. It is not good. It should be gone. Uh-huh. But I don't think that solves the underlying issue, because those people that then just like scroll Facebook or watch Twitter or whatever, they probably would just go back to Newsmax and get their news there.
I agree with you, but at least I think people have a bit of a better understanding. This is a little bit more tenuous. It's harder for me to prove this one, but like, I feel like people mm-hmm. at least have a better understanding of where their media is coming from, and things are a bit more honest back in those days. Like, I don't think if I would have asked the standard conservative in 2010 or the 2000s, where do you get your media from? I don't think the average conservative would have said, oh, you know, I get it from a variety of sources. Today, they can bullshit themselves into thinking that. Like in the 2000s, somebody like Joe Rogan wouldn't be able to explode all over right-wing media spheres because you wouldn't have these algorithms connecting and reinforcing these opinions so much. But because you do now, whenever these right-wingers who all have their talking points, whenever they go and visit Joe Rogan and he reinforces their points and then gets incorporated into that media ecosystem and then all of it starts to become self-reinforcing, that type of thing is enabling the creation of that ecosystem. Whereas 20 years ago, it would, like, Joe Rogan is just never going to click through political shit to become massively politically informed. Like, it's just not going to happen. It doesn't, unless, like, he would have to go, like, people back then would have to say, I'm going to click in. Like, you didn't become, or at least I'm not aware of it. Like, you didn't become accidentally radicalized, or at least I'm not aware of how that would happen. Cause you'd have to go and seek out, like, I grew up political. I loved debating people in high school. I went to a prep school, well, I would say that had very intelligent people. And I think there were like three other kids in my whole class that had strong political opinions that I debated. I want to say like two or three. I don't think anybody else did. Nowadays, I feel like if I go to an average school, and maybe this isn't true, maybe I should ask Nathan this, I guess, that where I go to a high school class, I feel like half the class or more are going to have very, very strong opinions about everything. And I feel like that's because so much of culture has gotten connected to these like social media worlds where everybody's being roped into everything. Whereas before I'd have to go and seek out politics. Now it's served to me if the algorithm thinks I can engage with it in a way that's going to keep me clicking through more posts.
I agree insofar that I think you're probably right with saying that the conservatives now would say they are, quote unquote, taking a balanced diet of media. Uh-huh. What I would disagree with is that I don't think that it would change anything politically. Like, if you look at the Gallup polls regarding media consumption since the beginning of the 2000s, conservatives have essentially consumed the same right-wing media, so just starting with Fox News and then Newsmax, and then later on the influencer world. But it is the same media. And even though if they say, well, now I'm consuming a broader media apparatus, they still vote Republican, they still act Republican, and they still radicalize themselves as Republicans.
I do agree with you, maybe, that they would still consume some of the same news, but like something happened with just conservatives that didn't happen with liberals. Compare Bernie Sanders with Donald Trump. Both of them are populist figures, but if Bernie Sanders would have been president, if we would have gone from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama to Bernie Sanders, we would say, we've definitely moved along a bit to the left. But the departure from Obama to Sanders isn't even remotely as crazy as the departure from Bush to Trump or the other candidates that were even on stage. Like, think about the difference between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and then compare that to the difference between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. It's like there's something happened there that enabled that conservative ecosystem to just drive. You mentioned that radicalization phenomenon that just drove the entire conservative movement in this country off a ledge way more than it ever did on the Democratic side.
Have you ever listened? Sorry, what I'll say now will be not fully finished because I haven't fully finished researching it, and I didn't expect this now to come up.
Sure.
But last time you asked me why have only Republicans built parallel institutions, and I couldn't really give a satisfactory answer to this beyond, well, the classical democratic institutions just broke away and never got replaced, whereas Republicans kept their private equity institutions.
Okay.
I think that answer is somewhat incomplete. I think now that I've like read more into it, the Republicans, not we don't have to call them Republicans, but one party in the United States was pro-civil rights, and one party, the same party would necessarily have to be anti-secession. Or pro-reconstruction. The United States, ever since the Civil War, has been split into the ex-secessionists, the anti-reconstructionists, and the quote-unquote pro-unionists.
Okay.
You can see this in the voting patterns of Nixon's election. Nixon, through the Southern Strategy, tried to catch low-income, lower-education voters that used to vote Democratic, but throughout the civil rights movement, became increasingly alienated with the common, quote-unquote, black culture. And if you listen to Nixon's speeches, it doesn't really, that doesn't sound like the big unifying president that we maybe now think of presidents of the past century. And Reagan is the same. Those people courted racists. I'm sorry to say this directly, but those people, as a matter of fact, courted racists and tried to stage their political power on the racist South. which is still in effect today. And I didn't think there is as much of a surprise if you called a racist voter base, analogous to the AfD in Germany, where people just called racists to go into power. If you called a racist voter base, you eventually end up with a racist in power. I can't really tell you where the jump is between George Senior and Judge Junior, Bush Senior and Bush Junior, because I just haven't gotten there. But at least Nixon and Reagan were trying to, were doing their best to court those secessionists. And then it isn't surprising if the party that suddenly tries to go back in time, remove the civil rights, remove quote-unquote human rights, suddenly happens to bring forth a Donald Trump. Does that make sense, or is that too disconnected from you?
I understand what you're saying, but I'm not viewing Donald Trump, I guess, through like a moral lens. I'm more viewing him as through an epistemic one, that like from Donald Trump's morality aside, it's just the fact that he can lie so much and fabricate so much. And then the moral depravity is more than just racism. Like, racism wasn't even, I don't think, like the top three morally depraved things that Trump had engaged in. Yeah, go ahead.
As I understood it, the question you just asked earlier, which I tried to answer, was why is it the case that the Republicans just walked themselves off a ledge, whereas the Democrats were Obama and then
relatively
like
tethered,
worst, Bernie Sanders? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my answer, or the answer that I'm trying to give, is that the Republicans, for the longest time, haven't said that yet, but they have employed anti-liberal and deplorable authoritarian tactics. But they have courted a voter base that is staunchly anti-liberal. And it is unsurprising that if you court a voter base and institutions that, again, recourt that voter base, that want to like bring forth someone who is more, let's call it, authoritarian, that eventually this ends in a Donald Trump. And that those people especially are...
I don't think I necessarily disagree with that, yeah. I don't know how that... I don't think I necessarily disagree with that. Also, fuck, because I do have to watch this live and learn shit. Give me your final thoughts or wrap this up. Yeah, what do you got? Or bring us to landing.
No,
yeah,
I might return eventually once I've written the outline fully. The point that I'm just trying to make is... the thing that I want to go back to are twofold. Uh-huh. One... when you speak about bad faith actors, it feels like there's one set of rules that we have to adhere to, and that's it. That is not how politics work. If we go to, I don't know, let's imagine we go to like the original liberals. Let's imagine we go to like George Washington or whatever, the Civil War, not the Civil War, the birth of the Americas people. Uh-huh. We have the British who don't represent the Americans in their parliament, and then someone like Washington says, well, those British are bad faith actors. They are not really. I know they are not representing them, but they are just doing their own thing. And Washington and his cohorts were only able to establish a system that expelled the British through force and through might makes right. The same way wars have been fought in Europe. Let's imagine you're like,
yeah, but
John
a war
Stuart
is
Mill.
Definitionally it's like sorry. Trying to destroy the current order and set up a new one now, right? Like, we don't want there to be wars in the United States between our two political parties.
We don't have, just because I say might makes right doesn't mean we have to have a war, but there needs to be a strong reconstitution of how the government works.
I agree with you and that like if, the rule set can change over time. But there's probably some borders that shouldn't. Like, if right now, if Donald Trump were to say today, like, I'm going to send the FBI to go and assassinate Plattner. Like, I don't think, would you come on tomorrow and say, like, well, you know, Democrats maybe need to think about who they want to assassinate when they come in office, right? I don't think you would say that, right?
No, I don't think I would say, well, mm-hmm. I don't what? Think so, no. Okay, let's say I don't think so.
Yeah, let's say that. Because that would be like a bridge too far, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Not necessarily, but I think the point that you're making is the bridge too far is your principles. At the end of the day, you need to ask yourself what roads do you not want to take and what bridges do you not want to cross.
I understand that we'd have to go deeper into this, but the broader argument I'm going to make is that like it's not just mine. I think that the Republican strategy relies on a one-sided thing that would necessarily create a worse country if both sides were to follow.
I don't mean you. I mean, like, you, the Democratic Party. I'm sorry.
But even me, the Democratic Party, broadly speaking, the reason why these rule sets exist is because if both sides broadly follow them, it produces a better outcome for all players involved. And that the Republicans right now have established a rule set that if Democrats were to follow it, it would be over for the country if both sides did it. But they only do it because if they can benefit if only their side follows it.
Okay, just to end on that point.
Sure.
And maybe we can pick this up eventually. Uh-huh. Would you say then the goal of the Democrats should be to enforce their rules on the Republicans?
Kind of, yeah. Or at least venture far enough outside their rule sets to match the Republicans to demonstrate that, like, if we both do this, it's going to be a clusterfuck. Like, I think this was best emblemized when AOC said, wow, 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 if you want to get rid of gerrymandering, come sign the fucking legislation. Because Republicans have kind of gotten lit the fuck up a little bit over the gerrymandering stuff. And I think that was good. And I think that, like, I don't know if it'll happen this legislative session coming up. And I don't know 2028 if we'll remember it enough. But, like, I would say that we're closer now to having, like, a federal ban on gerrymandering than we ever were, at least in my lifetime. After Republicans have seen, like, if you were to have, like, assume we had a president that wasn't a fucking decrepit, brain-dead, crazy authoritarian moron. Assume we had a president who was like, okay, I want to bring the country together and we're going to ban partisan gerrymandering or whatever. I think the country would be in a much more amenable state right now to it than they would have been prior to Democrats, you know, pulling off gerrymanders across several states.
Maybe. I don't want to push it too hard just to, like, for time's sake. No, the other thing that I want to leave you with is I feel like Americans have to leave behind the idea that we can have, like, we can have a kind of anarchist political state where just everything goes, and irregardless of what you say politically and irregardless of what you do, as long as you don't murder people and as long as you don't, I don't know, incite violence, people can stay in the political discourse. I think there needs to be, like, you see this in Germany, where we now have the discourse if the AfD should be banned. Where I would say there is a point if you staunchly say in your speeches and to a certain extent in your program, we need to abolish human rights. You are not compatible with the constitution and you are illegal here. And that structure, that parallel, quote unquote, institution of the party needs to be banned within the country. And then we have to deal with all the consequences, which might not be easy, but it is better than to just allow someone who openly advocates against the constitution and the state. And I think I do get that, like, as an American culturally, that is a very hard pill to swallow, and I don't think I can convince you of this right now. But that is, like, the following point moving forward, that there is no bad faith, one, because everyone just, at the end of the day, tries to further their ideology and tries to win, and whoever wins gets to make the rules. And two, as such, Democrats need to move forward and ban every unconstitutional part of the Republican Party.
Okay.
And enforce that rule. Is okay.
All right. I'll keep it in mind.
Any last words?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Can I, like, one sentence, ask something very cringe?
Go. What?
Whenever you speak about me, you, like, say, or you use the adage of that European fucker or that neuroscience fucker. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe not use that? Not call me a fucker, perhaps?
Oh, I thought you didn't like being called European. I'll think about it, okay?
Oh, haha. Very gracious of you. Okay. Have a good evening.
Have fun, bye.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
What a guy. Hello, what? Yeah, quick, go, 1 minute. Yes. I know it was a violation of international law. I did tell them that wasn't the context of our argument, though. But
but I just wanted to bring it up to people's attentions because you didn't. Like, that guy's smart, so I didn't want to interrupt. And, you know, sometimes you get a non-retarded caller, and that's nice. But I am dumbfounded but his international law take about if you just occupy people and then settle people there, then it becomes illegal magically under international law. I mean, just bring up the example of Transnistria, for example, that has been for 34 years unrecognized by the UN and by the international law. So, yeah, it's still considered just Russian-occupied territory or like a frozen conflict zone, and nobody recognize it just because, you know, 34 years has passed and it doesn't make it like such an easy might makes right argument as he's trying to make it in modern times, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I brought up Yugoslavia and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, that typically the UN has to agree. There has to be like some kind of consensus on borders. You can't just...
That wasn't a good example, to be honest, on your end.
Well, because, it was a good example because de facto Transnistria does exist the same way that broken territories in Georgia, you know, are things. They're just not UN recognized because post, you know, World War II, we generally need some type of UN body to recognize the, you know, the southern borders and independence of a particular state.
And there has to be like agreement between the parties of the conflict, and which would be three parties in Transnistria, mm-hmm. and also like the international organizations like recognizing this thing. Not to say that people can't, you know, do it that way. Obviously, they can't settle a fuck ton of people and create them problems, and you don't know what to do with the people then that are there. You know, it's all sorts of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, like, settlements work that way to complicate the situation and to make it borderline impossible to then resolve. But there are many situations like that, Abkhazia, like Nagorno-Karabakh, and all sorts of shit that are all like that, basically, up until recently, because Azerbaijan took Nagorno-Karabakh pretty much entirely, because Russians are lousy allies, so they didn't defend it for Armenia, I mean. Yeah, but that's all I wanted, really.
Okay. Yep. Thank you very much. Be careful. Bye-bye. Stay safe.